From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and we begin this hour with devastation in Oklahoma. Late this afternoon, a massive tornado tore through the Oklahoma City area. Much of the town of Moore appears to have been leveled, with entire neighborhoods not simply damaged, but obliterated. Joining us now is NPR science correspondent John Hamilton, who has done a lot of reporting on tornadoes before. And John, talk a bit about the path of this tornado and the destruction that it's brought.
Well, if you look at it on the weather maps, it looks like it cut a large swath that went a few miles south of Oklahoma City. So that would have taken it right through Moore. And that's a number of suburban communities, a lot of houses, a lot of schools. And there were reports that this tornado was on the ground for 40 minutes, which gives it a lot of time to cause damage.
And the strength or the intensity of this tornado, what have you been hearing?
It's a little hard to tell because most of the reports are preliminary, but people are saying it's at least a 4 or 5, and judging from the pictures with the devastation that was clear, that would put it in that category. Now, a 4 or 5 on the tornado scale would talk about winds of 166 to 200 miles an hour, maybe more. And when you get winds of 200 miles an hour, there's very little left after it passes by.
Yeah, and the images that we're seeing from television are just horrifying. I mean, they show entire neighborhoods in Moore that are flattened, and we've seen reports of schools that were hit, rescue operations underway to try to get the children out of those schools that were destroyed. This follows, John, a string of very destructive tornadoes yesterday as well in this area. And did people have warnings that these were coming?
Yeah, well, of course, usually tornadoes occur in groups like this. And so yesterday the conditions were favorable, so too today, and as I understand it, tomorrow as well. And yes, people had warning. For one thing, we're talking about the time of year and the place in the country where you most expect to see tornadoes. So if anybody is aware of the danger, it's people living in these areas. And they have been told for many hours before these particular tornadoes spun up that the conditions were ripe for something happening. And as I understand it, when the tornadoes did form and touched down, there was at least 15 minutes of warning to people in the path. So people at least had time to get to someplace low and a little safer.
What are the conditions that lead to tornadoes like this, John?
Well, basically, you have cold air coming down from the north and the west and storms, thunderstorm systems moving along, and it meets warm air coming up from the Gulf. And it's the collision of those two that causes tornadoes to spin up and create this kind of devastation. And it happens in that place along Tornado Alley, most likely. That's sort of a line where this tends to occur.
And there are warnings, John, still from the National Weather Service of other tornadoes that could still hit this area?
That's correct. As I understand it, there are warnings that they're expecting more tornadoes throughout this evening and a number more tomorrow when the conditions will still be very, very favorable for more tornadoes spinning up.
Okay. And again, at this point, no word yet on casualties. The scale and the size of this tornado would lead you to believe that people would have to have been hurt by what happened there.
If this is truly a Category 4 or 5, and there are reports that it was a mile across, which makes it a very big tornado, going through a suburban area, it's virtually impossible that you would not have deaths and many casualties.
Okay. John, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's John Hamilton.
On the night of October 19th, 1984, Eric Vogel was uneasy about flying. But the young pilot was behind schedule, and he felt like his job was on the line. So he took off, as he did most days, shuttling between remote communities dotting the Canadian wilderness.
It was snowing. The de-icer didn't work. The autopilot didn't work. And his co-pilot had been bumped to fit one more passenger on the 10-seater plane.
And in the middle of that, he's hearing these chunks of ice coming off the props and banging like rocks against the fuselage. And he made a calculation error. He thought he was past the high point, but there was another rise of land, 2,500 feet, and he hit that top of that rise. So it was a miracle that anyone got out of that plane alive.
Carol Shaben is the author of a book about that crash, a book called Into the Abyss. 6 people were killed. Shaben's own father, a politician named Larry Shaben, survived along with 3 others, the pilot Eric Vogel, a prisoner named Paul Archambault, and the police officer escorting him.
Scott Deschamps was that Canadian Mountie. The moment before impact sticks with him all these years later.
If you're driving down the road in a car and you run off into the rough for a second, mm-hmm. you hear that, and you pull back onto the road. And that's what I heard, just for a second, something rough. And I remember thinking, the plane's not supposed to do that. And before I could even finish that thought, maybe a few seconds later, I just remember everything breaking apart. And that's the last I remember of the crash.
Okay, we now know the plane crashed through a bank of trees, and then as the fuselage plowed into the ground, upside down, broken bits of plane sheared off the roof, peeled open like a sardine can. But when Scott Deschamps opened his eyes, he only knew that he was trapped, partly buried in the ground.
Then I felt someone tugging on my foot, and it was Paul. And he had found me. He had come back to the plane to find me. There was great agony with him pulling off chunks of plane before he even got to the dirt that encased me. And I was completely disoriented, and I didn't know where I was or what had happened. And it took me probably 10 minutes before I realized the plane had crashed. And I can remember sitting in the plane. I remember looking out the open, broken fuselage at the snow falling. And in the far distance, I could see the glow of a fire. And we got by the fire, and that's where we sat most of the night.
So Paul managed to start a fire. Yeah. It's extremely cold. You're in the wilderness. And as I'm reading this, I begin thinking about Jack London's To Build a Fire. A guy's desperate to build a fire, and if he fails, he's going to die. And then as I'm reading your account, well, the fire goes out. You run out of fuel. What was going through your mind then?
There's a forest of trees, trees, trees everywhere, but not a branch to burn. And that's the truth. You have no axe. You have no way of gathering wood. You can't find fallen wood because there's 3.5 feet of snow. And we sent Paul on a constant vigilance for anything that would burn. Fire was life, Steve. Fire was life. And at different times during the night, we had no fire. And I'd been on many search and rescue situations as a Mountie where you'd go into these camps looking for lost hunters or motor vehicle accidents in the back bush. And you find the people eventually, but you find them as frozen corpses. And I figured that's how we would be found.
Of course you were found in the end, just in time. The four of you survived. And Carol Shaben, I'd like to know how people's lives changed after that incident.
Well, Steve, each of these survivors was completely transfigured by what had happened that night. And all of their lives took sharp turns, if you will. Paul Archambault, who had a long prison record, who, you know, was an accused criminal, a drifter who'd been drifting across the country since he was 15 or 16. He went back. He got on a plane 2 days later and faced charges, faced a judge in court. And the judge said, "You are to be commended for your actions, and I exonerate you of all charges." Hmm. So this ne'er-do-well vagabond who'd had nothing but hard luck was all of a sudden hailed as a hero. So took a dramatic turn that way.
What about your father?
My dad was changed. He was a changed man. He began to look at his life and judge his worth as a man from that point forward by what he accomplished in the years, the extra years he felt he got that others on that plane did not. And he felt like the political life that he had been living, it wasn't enough. He needed to do more. And he floundered for a long time trying to figure out what that was. And after 9/11, he became very, very strident about trying to build bridges across cultures, trying to increase understanding and tolerance. And my dad created this incredible philanthropic life and this incredible legacy that I think was a greater tribute than his 16 years of political career.
Scott Deschamps, how did this event change you?
Well, Steve, I made a bucket list before bucket lists were made. I had a very profound list of things I wanted to do if I was ever going to get off that mountain. And you know, There's 10 things, and I just finished them. It took me 25 years to finally finish the last one.
What were some of the things on the list?
One of the things that most profound, and I voiced it at the time, was the fact that I was going to die on that stupid mountain, and I never had a family. So I went forward very specifically to be a great parent, and I am. I have two wonderful children. I'd never been to university. So when I left the Mounted Police, I did a bachelor's degree, and then I went on and I did a master's degree. And I had a whole bunch of other things. Now I live in peace, and life is good.
Carol Shaben is the author of Into the Abyss, the story of four plane crash survivors. Scott Deschamps was one of those survivors. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You can find some fruits, like apples, in just about any grocery store in the country, but other fruits have gotten a bit lost in today's food business. Unlike their sweet counterparts, sour cherries are too fragile to ship far, and that means most people never get to taste a fresh one. Instead, they end up in that iconic American dessert, the cherry pie. Well, today we can report that the humble sour cherry is in the middle of an unlikely renaissance. NPR's Dan Charles explains.
Tart cherry juice is now showing up in health food stores as a nutrient-packed superfood. There are studies, many paid for, it must be noted, by the Cherry Marketing Institute, showing that this sour sweet fruit can help reduce insomnia or pain in joints and muscles. Researcher Mitchell Seymour at the University of Michigan Medical School fed tart cherries to rats.
And we saw some significant reductions in things like inflammation in the animals. We saw some improved insulin resistance.
If all this research gives the tart cherry business a boost, Seymour is happy to see it.
I think it's exciting. I think it's a good product, and it's nice to know that a majority of that product is produced in my home state of Michigan.
In fact, the western edge of his home state, along the shores of Lake Michigan, grows something like 3/4 of the country's sour cherries with their addicting counterpoint of tangy and sweet, perfect for baking. And this year, the orchards are looking great. Mike Van Ackmel's farm near the town of Hart is a sea of white blossoms shimmering in the sunlight.
I mean, how's it getting better than this out here today? There's nothing I'd rather be growing than tart cherries and apples. You know, that's what I told my wife. If I was to die tomorrow, you know, there's nothing that I could ask for, even after going through a year like we did last year.
Last year was no good at all. It started with a deceptively mild spring.
It was real warm early. Just everything was way advanced.
The trees blossomed, and then
23rd of March, got a real cold night.
Van Ackmel stayed up that whole night watching the thermometer.
It got about 3:30, and temperature just started dropping, and it didn't matter what we did. It kept dropping and dropping.
The blossoms froze. The crop was ruined. Now, there's a reason why all those trees bloomed and froze in unison. The vast majority of tart cherry trees in the U.S. are genetically identical, but they don't have to be. There's a world of different kinds of tart cherries out there in their homeland of Eastern Europe, and one scientist, Amy Iazzoni at Michigan State University, is bringing some of that diversity to the United States.
Somebody needs to do this.
Iazzoni is in a hurry. She has to be this time of year. Her tart cherry trees are blooming, ready for pollination. Iazzoni reaches for a blossom, and suddenly her hands slow down. She gently pulls away part of the flower, the pollen-producing part. She throws that away. She wants to fertilize this flower with pollen from another tree.
Did you see how that worked? This is how we prepare the branch for pollen.
Iazzoni is the country's one and only tart cherry breeder. When she took this job in 1981, she wasn't exactly sure where to start. The only tart cherries she could find were from America's standard commercial variety, Montmorency. But a cherry breeder needs different kinds of cherry trees to make those genetic crosses, reshuffling the genes and creating new combinations. A plant breeder with just one variety is like a painter with only one color.
I got to see Montmorency and Montmorency and Montmorency. So, okay, spring comes. What am I going to cross it with? I have nothing. Well, I should go to Eastern Europe. And can I get there and back before my bloom? And I could. I did it.
This was during the Cold War. An iron curtain stood between her and those tart cherry varieties. But Iozone got official permission to cross through it, and she followed the tart cherry bloom northward across Europe from Yugoslavia to Poland. She collected pollen all the way and brought it back to fertilize blossoms in Michigan. Along the way, she also got a taste of a whole different tart cherry culture. In Hungary, for instance, tart cherry trees line village streets.
Their tart cherries are so good, they eat them fresh. And I actually have seen in Hungary the price of tart cherries higher than sweet cherries.
More trips followed. Today, 30 years later, Iozone's breeding orchard is a spectacular exhibition of the tart cherry's family tree. There are short bushes and tall trees. Perhaps most interesting right now, there are trees that were not bothered by last spring's freeze.
This is Tamaris from Mitrinsk, Russia.
It's a modest little tree. It stands out because it's a really late bloomer.
Montmorency has pretty much finished blooming, and this thing just sits there, sits there, sits there.
Last year, this tree didn't bloom during the warm early spring, so there were no blossoms to freeze during the cold snap. It bloomed later and produced its normal crop of cherries. Now, those cherries aren't very good, so Amy Iozone is doing more cross-pollinating, mating this tree with others that do make nice cherries, collecting the seeds, then planting them. Right now, she's waiting to collect pollen from some of that next generation, especially the little trees that are blooming really late.
See?
Little buds coming.
Little flowers. Those are what we're anxiously waiting for.
What she hopes to get, eventually, is a late-blooming tart cherry tree that yields a big crop of great-tasting cherries. But this is just a part of her bigger project, introducing more variety into the tart cherry landscape, trees and flavors that might even change the image and culture of tart cherries in America. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Let's talk hockey this morning. In the NHL playoffs last night, the last two Stanley Cup champions were both in action. The Boston Bruins beat the New York Rangers, giving the Bruins a 3-0 lead in their second-round series. But the reigning champion Los Angeles Kings lost to the San Jose Sharks, and their series is now tied at 2-2. Joining me now to talk hockey is NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. Hey, Tom.
Hi, David.
Well, let's start on the West Coast. The San Jose Sharks beat the Kings 2-1, and it sounds like it was a pretty sloppy game.
Yeah, on sloppy ice, actually. You know, we've gotten used to having this cold weather sport in warmer climates, but sometimes the weirdness of it comes out. And less than stellar ice conditions in San Jose, slushy, or there were soft spots, apparently, reportedly is why players were sometimes taking a whack at the puck and missing or hitting off target. The San Jose coach, Todd McClellan, said, "It's California. It was 90 degrees the other day. The ice crews do what they can, but..." And apparently it happens elsewhere this time of year, including at Staples Center in L.A. Kings coach Daryl Sutter says players sometimes compensate with shorter passes and harder shots. So we'll see how much of a role, if any, the ice plays as these teams battle in their final three games of this series.
Yeah, I'm going to get myself in trouble for saying this, but I've never thought that warm weather cities should have hockey teams, which leads us to cities where hockey belongs, like New York and Boston. They faced off last night.
And Pittsburgh, right, David?
Of course, yeah. That's right. So the Rangers and Bruins. The Rangers, I mean, have had some outstanding goaltending, but it sounds like it broke down last night.
Well, yeah, Rangers goaltender Henrik Lundqvist was his usual magnificent self, despite a reported shoulder injury from an earlier game. He had 32 saves, but he couldn't save two in the third period, and the Bruins broke through, scored twice, and won 2-1. The Rangers are down 0-3. They can take a little heart, though. Unlike the NBA, where a team down 0-3 in a playoff series never has come back to win, it's happened three times in NHL history. The Toronto Maple Leafs in 1942. The Islanders in 1975, and just 3 years ago, the Philadelphia Flyers did it.
And Tom, all joking aside about warm weather, I mean, we do have some of these cold classic NHL cities, some of the original NHL franchises in the playoffs this year. It's kind of cool.
It is. Four of the so-called original six have advanced to the second round of these playoffs: Boston, New York, Chicago, and Detroit. And that's happened only one other time in the last 20 years where you had four of the six advance this far. That was in 2010. With that happening, you know, there is this sense of history to these playoffs, although with the NHL in recent years, the playoffs and ultimately the Stanley Cup winner is more a function of what's new. Since 2003, you've had a different champion every season, including four first-time winners, Tampa Bay in 2004, Carolina in 06, Anaheim in 07, and the Kings last year.
Well, and the kind of parity you're talking about, Tom, I feel like we're seeing that in the playoffs this year. I mean, the top seeds, Pittsburgh, Chicago, had, you know, great records, but they're both in grind 'em out series right now.
They really are, and we see it another way. Hockey watchers say that parity is one of the big reasons why there are so many overtime games. This year in particular, there have been 20 overtime games in these playoffs, 17 in the first round. That set a new NHL record. Close games obviously make for more excitement, and with this revolving door of Stanley Cup champions, that engages a lot more fans who can rightfully claim their team has a shot at the title if they just make the playoffs. This is all positive for a league that was drenched in negativity earlier in the season because of the lockout.
Yeah, they've really come back from that. Well, enjoy the excitement, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, David.
It's NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman.
We're going to switch gears now and take another look at the stock market. Last week, about the same time, we talked about how the Dow has been hitting record highs. But did you know that stock ownership in this country is at record lows? According to a recent Gallup poll, only about half of Americans, 52%, now own stocks. That's the lowest level since Gallup started tracking that number back in 1998. We wondered what, if anything, that means, so we've called once again upon one of our money coaches, Robin Farzad. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek, and he's with us now. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. How are you?
Good. Well, just to recap, we're seeing almost daily records on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. I know that there's some dispute about whether that number really means anything, but what do you think that means?
I think across the board, you're seeing markets in the United States hit highs, and it's not just the Dow. I think it illustrates writ large that the money is awash in the system. The Federal Reserve has this gigantic fire hose, and it's splashing money onto the plane. And inevitably, it's going to make its way down to corporate balance sheets, and especially when people can't really get an opportunity in their savings. Institutional investors have yields that are so low. They're going to chase return in the stock market, obviously.
Now, a lot of people think, and in fact, our guest last week said, that even if you aren't in the market, this is good news for the average American. Do you agree?
It's good news psychologically. You get that ping on the nightly news. The Dow ends at another high today, the S&P, the NASDAQ at a 12.5-year high. But it's not very comforting if you're not exposed to that. If you say, well, what if I didn't liquidate my 401k 3-4 years ago? What if I didn't take that hardship withdrawal? I'd actually feel the wealth that I get a brokerage statement now that shows that the balances are higher. It's a regretful incident when, in fact, you did have to sell out. And right now you realize that if you didn't, if you could have gotten funds somewhere else, you would be partaking in this rally financially.
Well, that was going to be my next question, which is, why is it that the percentage of Americans who own stocks is at this point? Now, I should, you know, mention that since 1998, that's not a huge long period of time, but the high was of stock ownership in this country was 65% before the financial crisis hit. Now to 52%, that is a real number of people who are no longer in the market. So is it your view that that's mainly because of people who cashed out because they needed emergency funds and that's where they found their emergency funds?
I think they also got spooked in the market that was down 40%. You had a flash crash after that. It was very easy to say, gosh, the world is falling apart. The last thing I can depend on is this whimsical stock market. I'm getting out. In addition to that, I could be foreclosed on. I could potentially lose my job. If I didn't lose my job, why am I not tapping this asset, be it in my brokerage account or my company-sponsored 401k? And we saw that. We saw that in spades. We saw hardship withdrawals. We saw companies reporting that this was being done at a record clip. And very few people could have imagined that in less than 5 years, the market would have round-tripped back and been at an all-time high right now.
What would you have to say about why this matters? I mean, why do you think this is important for the country to think about? I mean, because, you know, the theory behind moving from defined benefit pensions to defined contribution plans, 401ks, 403bs, you know, things like that, is that people should have the right to decide, you know, how they use their money. If they feel that their money is better spent, say, paying off a mortgage or staying out of foreclosure, they should have the right to do that. What's your theory, or what would you have to say about why you think this matters, why it's important to talk about this?
Well, because we're on our own. As you describe yourself, these are self-directed plans now. The company is effectively handing you a series of pamphlets from a mutual fund company and says, go and decide on your own. And you're free to pull out the money when you want to do it. You're free to not contribute when you want to do it. And time and again, we see that the behavior is self-destructive. The investor thinks he's doing the right thing and getting out when the market is tanking. And right now, you see more and more investors who had the money sidelined want to get back in when the market is hitting an all-time high. There's no, you know, I don't want it to sound too paternalistic. There's no one out there necessarily guiding hands. There's no great financial coach at companies that will go out there and hold every individual investor's hand. And this matters because increasingly you're on your own. Increasingly, we don't know about the solvency of Social Security. You're going to need the market to help you, especially after your savings and retirement accounts have taken such a wallop in this Great Recession.
Don't you feel that this is also going to have an effect on equality or inequality of net worth? I mean, we often talk about sort of inequality of income, but the inequality of net worth of people, the kinds of assets that people have to live on later on. I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that there could be a problem down the road when people who are middle income have pulled out money out of the market and then maybe 10 years from now don't have enough to live on in retirement?
I absolutely think that's a problem. And yes, the stock market still remains the province of the wealthy or the upper classes who have access to the type of jobs, for example, that can give you a 401k plan, that have the disposable income to put in separate brokerage accounts. And you've already seen such a widening of fortunes, a kind of a divergence of fortunes in this case. And it's only seen worse. I mean, the Gallup data showed how the 30 to 49 age group saw the biggest declines in equity ownership, and unemployment disproportionately hits this group, foreclosures disproportionately hits this group. So there's a lot of catching up to do. And it's a quandary right now. Do you get back in when the market's at an all-time high? Do you even have money on the sidelines to get back in? There are no easy answers.
Another quote from the study: while soaring stock values may be an incentive to jump back into the market, continued high unemployment appears to be acting as a barrier. Without a job, some Americans may simply be unable to afford stock investments, while others may fear the market is still too risky as long as joblessness remains a national problem. End quote. Again, that's from the study. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I think it still speaks to the fact that this is an optional thing for investors to get back in the market. When you look at it, though, over time, you're going to need something to help you accelerate, to help you catch up with the self-inflicted damage of the past 5 or 6 years. Not just self-inflicted again, Michelle. A lot of this came from out of left field. It's the worst economic calamity of our lifetimes. But again, you have to be able to have something, an asset class that can keep up with inflation, that can keep up with the cost of living, and do you something for retirement. And we've seen the market be that asset class historically.
And no more than a third of younger and lower income households are in the stock market. So final thought, Robin, younger Americans, do you think that there are implications for them?
Yeah, definitely. These are the years where it really matters, where you could really do yourself a big favor by being involved in the market, by if you're single, if you have a job, if you're in a position to garnish something from your wages and put it in a 401k plan, that is where it could really compound and do great things for you. And if you're not, you're losing out on your 20s. It's definitely a great age to be there, to be diversified. And unfortunately, these are the people who look back and when they are of means are going to say, wow, I missed out on that time. And I think this is where policymakers have to look more into financial education. You don't have people immediately out of college or people of that age necessarily thinking that this is when I need to buck up and have some sort of financial self-determination. It's left to your HR provider at work to kind of tell you something or two about it.
If that person still is there. Robin Farzad is a contributor to Bloomberg Business Week. He was with us from Richmond, Virginia. Robin, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle. Take care.
As we mentioned, President Obama's commencement address comes the day after he delivered an hour-long speech on national security. The president talked about redefining the effort away from what he called a boundless global war on terror. Here to talk about what they heard in the president's speech yesterday are our Friday political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
We heard the president say yesterday, America is at a crossroads. He said we're making decisions that will define the type of nation and world we leave to our children. And in much of the speech, he talked specifically about drone strikes. David, you first. What shift, if any, did you hear in what the president had to say.
Crossroads is a bit hyperbolic. There are a couple of phases to the war on terror. I would say there was the militant, super aggressive phase, which you might call the Dick Cheney phase, first 3 years. I think the big shift happened early in the second Bush term when Condoleezza Rice and National Security Advisor Steve Hadley got involved. And that was the big shift, beginning to scale it back to something more normalized. And we've made progress since then in getting it to be normal. And in general, President Obama has rhetorically shifted a lot, but substantively shifted very little. And so I think he's continued the second Bush term, but making sensible adjustments. And I think this speech is a series of sensible adjustments, trying to get the drones out of the CIA toward the Defense Department, which seems appropriate, trying to scale back the level of general alarm of threat. So I'd say the big shift happened in the Bush years, but this is a sensible continuation of getting things back to a normal footing.
Interesting, though, that point that you raise about shifting it from the CIA to the military wasn't actually embedded in the speech itself. He didn't actually talk about
that. Right, and it's merely a preference. So it's not – we're not for sure, but I think most people – accept the idea that the CIA going around killing people with these weapons is probably – it's not the natural home for this program.
EJ, what about you? What evolution did you hear, if any, in the president's remarks?
Well, I think it was an adult speech that treated Americans as serious conversation partners. And indeed, there was a protester, Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, who interrupted the speech. And it was fascinating. The president really treated her as a serious interlocutor and came back to her at the end of the speech. And I thought it was actually very significant that he really, as you suggested, said the global war on terror, which was never a very good formulation in my view, because you don't wage war on methods of violence. He said that's behind us. And he had a very complicated phrase, but it's actually quite precise. He said it's a series of persistent targeted efforts to dismantle specific networks of violent extremists. It's a very Obama pragmatic, practical thing to say. I think that he moved in certain directions without fundamentally changing. He went back to the effort to close Guantanamo, but did not announce its closure. He put restrictions on the use of drones, but said we still needed to use them. So I think there'll be critics from the left and the right, but I think it was a classic balanced Obama kind of speech.
You mentioned the protester Medea Benjamin, and we have some tape of this exchange. Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, and she was shouting about Guantanamo and civilians killed in drone strikes. And at first, in one of her several interruptions, we heard the president respond this way.
Why don't you let me address it, ma'am? Why don't you sit down and I will tell you exactly what I'm going to do.
And then a bit later, I believe it's as she's being removed from the room, he said, the voice of that woman is worth paying attention to.
These are tough issues. And the suggestion that we can gloss over them is wrong.
David, let me ask you about this. I mean, does this illustrate the fine line? You're talking about sort of the shift away from Bush administration policies, many of which have been embedded also in the Obama administration's
term. First, let me say I think Code Pink are reprehensible narcissists, by the way. They interrupt these events continually. This is not the proper way to have protest.
It's free speech, David. It's a free country.
There's also such thing as civility and respect.
She's a known quantity. She was still allowed into the room, right. Or someone didn't seem to know she was there.
Say the situation in Guantanamo, I remember speaking to somebody in the Bush administration where they said, you know, it never occurred to us we could announce the closure of Guantanamo before we found a place for the people. We did things in the wrong order. And so they've announced the closure without finding a place. But I think this is a problem that both administrations and certainly this administration has been aware of. The evidence is tainted. You can't let these people out because they are dangerous. So there's just a series of horrible problems that the Bush administration had, that the Obama administration has on this and on drones. Drones are a very problematic use of force, and yet they are effective. And you're thrown in these circumstances, in these horrible circumstances, where you've got no bad options. And I think they're dealing with it quite rationally.
No good options.
Excuse me.
If there were no bad options, yeah. it would all be very easy, wouldn't it?
That's column writing. and so I do think they're doing quite a mature job of this.
Could I just say one of the reasons it's been so hard to close Guantanamo is because Congress, and this is really a problem in both parties, Congress keeps saying, well, you can't move them here. Well, if we can't move them to a secure facility inside the United States and you can't find countries to send it to, it becomes more difficult to close Guantanamo. And so I think that Obama, with what he said, is trying to bring some pressure back. It's an issue he kind of dropped for a while. and he's picking it up again.
David, very briefly, last word to you. I just want to have your reaction to the reaction from Republican Saxby Chambliss of Georgia after the speech, who said the terrorists will see the president's speech as a victory. We are changing course, he said, with no clear operational benefit. Does he have a point?
Word politics, ridiculousness. There's no change of course here. Show me the substantive change of course. It's just not a chance to do the same old line, the Democrats are weak. President Obama has not been weak on terror. There's just no substance to that. And so I regard that as a cheap shot.
And EJ, you get the last word. We have a few seconds left.
You know, I actually agree with David, so I'll just let it stand there.
There are no bad choices right now. David Brooks of The New York Times and EJ Dionne of The Washington Post and Brookings Institution, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.